Chapter 13. The First Strand Severed. Hot air, thick with petrochem fumes, choked the night. The manufactorums, the teeming bullet farms, the tank yards, the armories, all toiled without cease. Quotas were met, then increased. Plumes of black greasy smoke unspooled into the atmosphere from immense soot-stained chimney stacks. Industry ground on, relentless, desperate. Orbital craft arrived daily, their adamantium and battle-scarred bellies hungry for tithes of men and materiel. Entire hive cities of millions had been put to use, churning out ammunition, weapons, shells and armour, enslaved to a war with an appetite beyond satiation. Carter Eumenides had to stop to catch his breath, leaning on the corner of an abandoned watch station in lower quadrant Tartus. Here the streets ran close and in warrens. Though lower quadrant Tartus boasted over 50,000 souls, crammed in a habitation grid fit for half that number, Carter was alone. The war, he knew, had made hermits of them all. Where once these wretched streets would have been overrun with the dregs of humankind, the hawkers, the crude vendors, the night women, the pushers, the low gilders, the siphoners, the lamp men, the pit kings and the sump warders. Now not a soul stirred. Vendors closed early, if they opened at all. Businesses not dedicated entirely to the war had shut down. Even the pleasure dens were boarded up and silent. Horus was coming, so the wind said, and the wind reeked of oil and death. Carter glanced behind him, but couldn't see his pursuer anymore. He wasn't entirely sure he had seen it the first time, but he knew someone was after him. He had felt it, and he had learned, in his inordinately long life, to trust his feelings. He looked up, hoping to catch a glimpse of the sky and reaffirm his bearings. It had been a long time since he had come this low, hoping now the obscurity of the place would keep him safe. Through parting clouds of greasy smog, he caught a glimpse of an ugly cadaver-yellow sky. He saw flags, too. Banners still flew from the higher spires, professing allegiance to terror and the throne. The slogans in the lower sinks, the truly fetid underbelly, were less defiant. They prophesied an ending, a cessation of all things, and a slow degeneration into despair. From this angle, it was easier to guess which side might have the right of it. Heart hammering, his rebreather mask almost spent, Carter hurried on. He checked his sidearm first, the ammo gauge flashing green, reassuring him he had a maxed-out clip and another round ready in the breech. He was running again when he flipped a hexagonal orientation lens over his right eye to review the lower quadrant Tartus map schematic.
"Nearly there,"
he gasped, and balked at how terrified his voice sounded and how much it echoed. He took the tightest alleyways, the most circuitous route, and was beginning to think he might have escaped when he heard the thud of heavy boots, the dirty mechanized growl of armor servos carried on the throbbing air. Carter risked another glance behind him, but failed to see the shadows skipping across the rooftops giving chase. He felt it, though, the monstrous psychic presence that eclipsed Carter's meager abilities. There were two of them. The other one, the hound, he had come to think of him as, for he was tenacious and bled brutality like sweat from his paws, followed more overtly. But the night was dark, and the hound still far enough away that Carter could not see him either. The mind of the hound felt very different. It hurt behind the eyes to try to touch it, a pain that grew to nausea-inducing agony when Carter had tried to delve deeper into its subconscious, where he might extend some subtle influence. He had always been gifted. He knew this even as a child. It manifested as a kind of profound luck, a second sight almost, that had kept him from harm. A pity, Carter thought ruefully, that it had not warned him about the man who had come seeking him. Recruitment followed, into an order Carter did not truly understand, but one he joined willingly, for he trusted the man, and would go on to think of him as a friend. It had led to a long, long life. For Carter had not always been who he was now. He had needed to change. A beggar, an artist, a mercenary. He had played the roles, adopted the personas. He had kept ahead of his own immortality. How curious, then, that it felt as if that supposedly endless existence was coming to a finale at last. He needed to reach the man now, though not in person, for Carter had no idea where he might be or what mission he might be engaged in for them. A message would have to suffice, cast out into the ether like a ship in a bottle. Ahead, at last, the safe haven. It loomed at the end of a wide, paved esplanade, a fortress of stone and steel. A short flight of steps led up to the esplanade from street level. Carter leapt the steps two at a time, his fear lending him urgency and strength. As he reached a broad iron gate, the turret guns embedded in the paired watchtowers either side of the entrance tracked his movements. Flickering red targeting arrays painted his body. Carter delved into his uniform jacket, a black leather duster with a clenched fist holding a set of scales rendered in gold and patched over the left breast. He quickly pulled out his lock stave and held it up to the tracking beams. A few seconds lapsed that felt much longer, though he resisted the urge to look back again. They were coming, he knew, both of them. But now they would have to penetrate meter-thick rockcrete, face a pair of fully loaded autocannon turrets, and overwhelm a precinct house's entire garrison before they got to him. A chime sounded, dull, resonant. As the gate slowly slid open, Carter hoped these defences would give him enough time to reach the man he knew as John. Slipping through a crack in the gate the moment it was wide enough to admit him, Carter plunged inside the fortress precinct to immediately be met by his chief proctor. The man was broader than Carter, and a head taller in his grey combat armour. He clutched a shotgun across his chest, the icon of the fist and scales emblazoned proudly across his chest. A shock maul hung loosely from his belt, deactivated but fully charged.
"Judge Eumenides," said the chief proctor,
an invitation to be given orders.
"Seal the gates, Wrench," replied Carter,
shucking off his black duster and reaching for a proffered carapace breastplate from one of the other troopers present. Proctor Wrench had assembled 20 men in full combat armour, all bar two of them armed with shotguns. The odd men out carried heavy-grade plasma guns, the stub-nosed Brutus pattern variant, common to hive law enforcement on this world. The gate sequence reversed, locking bolts slamming into place with a dull metallic thud that boomed loudly in the drafty entrance hall.
"Use burners, Wrench! Melt the damn thing shut."
A slight tilt of the head suggested the chief proctor wanted to know why, but discipline had been ingrained to such a degree that he obeyed without question and snapped curt commands at two of his men to grab the necessary equipment and set to it.
"You hold here. Do you understand, Wrench?"
Wrench nodded, grim, resigned. Carter had voxed ahead as soon as he realized he was being followed. He had given Wrench a story about what was coming. Civil disobedience had become rife over the last few weeks, as if a fever had overtaken the populace and buried in them a root of such discord that it prompted mass acts of madness and insurrection. Privately, Carter had wondered if there was something more than just mania stoking these fanatical flames. He had planned on leaving his current life and retiring Carter Eumenides. He had been here long enough, and sometimes overheard comments about his surprising youthfulness. Comments led to investigation, which led to discovery. That could not be allowed to happen. He had decided that Carter would be posted off-world. He would play the part, the fond farewell, the grateful peace after his many years of service. Once aboard the shuttle, it would be easy. Change attire, accent, subtle facial expressions. He would become someone else, and then he would return, and the entire cycle would begin anew. Citywide disorder, possibly country or even planetary-wide, had put paid to that. He had overstayed, become trapped, and now someone had come for him, at last. The two troopers returned with the burners and started on the gate. Carter was already moving by then, holstering his sidearm and taking a modified Phobos pattern bolter handed to him by one of Wrench's men. The chief proctor was still shouting at his men, organizing them into position as Carter left the entrance hall and another reinforced door slammed shut and sealed behind him. He nodded to the 10 troopers in the next room, an armory, their brandished riot shields parting to let Carter through. A third door, also then sealed behind him, led Carter to a vox chamber, small enough to be cramped even for a man alone. Carter sat down in the only chair and engaged the device on the desk in front of him. It looked like an old gramophone, the long tubular neck of the vox corder leading all the way to a flaring receiver horn. Carter leaned in, the low crackle of the vox corder familiar but of little comfort. Outside, an explosion sounded, muffled but close. The wall shook, dislodging a train of dust. Then the lights died, and a red glow washed over everything as the emergency generatorium activated. Then the glow died too, and the darkness came. Then men began to die. Carter heard gunfire. Relayed through two sealed doors, it sounded indistinct, distant. The shouts of dying men did not. That easily penetrated his aegis. Bringing the bolter had been foolish. It was of no use to him here, not any more. He had taken it out of fear and some misguided belief that he could live through this. He would not live through this. So Carter leaned in again and started to speak. Wrench saw the doors blow off, a plosive charge tearing through their fixings with a roar, followed by a resonant clang of iron as they hit the ground. He didn't move. His men didn't move. They held steady.
"Targeters!" he said, trying to sound commanding.
20 red beams flashed out into the darkness, sweeping and intersecting. A grenade bounced in from outside, and every man tensed before smoke began to fill the entrance hall, turning the targeting beams grainy. Respirators were slipped on, and Wrench's slow, unsteady breathing filled his ears, magnified by his mask.
"Hold position,"
he said, trying to sound confident across the vox feed. Interrogatives from the sergeant in the next room flickered up on his flash visor, but he ignored them. The smoke had crept to every nook and cranny, the room engulfed and the excess spilling outside. Something moved within it, too fast to see, too veiled to even feel. But this was not Wrench's killer. No, he came a moment later and made no attempt to hide. The gunfire ended quickly. It ended with the resistance of his men, Carter knew. He thought he had heard a rifle snap amongst the booming retorts of combat shotguns and the whine of plasma guns. Now it was over, and the air grew still again. The vox corder crackled, dead air raining for a few seconds. Using a dusty old keypad, Carter punched in the transmit codes and was about to send the message when he felt a presence. Reaching for a pistol, an antique of alien origin that he always kept in this room with the other anachronistic items, Carter suddenly felt the knife at his neck. He half turned. He would have begged for mercy, but the deed was ignoble and would do no good anyway. Instead, his eyes widened as he came face to face with his killer.
"I did not think it would be you. I thought you..."
Carter stopped talking. He was drowning in his own blood, a red cascade issuing from the gash in his throat, an over-wide smile that kept on growing until it bled him white. Eldrad Ulthran stood over the man's corpse. He did not know him. He had not been privy to all of the Cabal's many operatives, but this one had been functionally immortal. At least his life was long-lived. He had suspected the man would have had many in order to hide his gift. The others would be harder to kill, the ones who could regenerate tissue. But that was for another time. Even immortality had its shades. At least this one would not return, and the skein of fate would be all the clearer for his absence. Operating the vox corder, marvelling at the crude, ancient, and yet surprisingly functional apparatus, he listened to the man's message. It was a warning to John. This one Eldrad did know. He had approached Grammaticus before, and would need to do so again.
"I can't let him warn you, John," he murmured,
and stretched out his hand. Lightning coursed through the apparatus, serpentine, pervasive, until all that remained was a smoking ruin and the last vestiges of dissipating corpuscent. And then even that was gone. The door opened, his mind providing the impetus, and Eldrad smelled hot copper. Then he stepped from the room to see what Narek had wrought.